Jalaluddin Rumi, who was born in the year 1207 in a town in today's Tajikistan, and died in 1273 in Konya, now in Turkey, has been the most popular poet in the United States since at least 2007. His poem, Come, Come, Whoever You Are, was set to music by my colleague, Lynn Unger, and it's now one of our favorite hymns. But here's how it sounds in the original Persian, which you might not have heard. This is inscribed above his tomb. Baza, baza haranche hasti, baza, gar kafir, gar gabar, gar bot parasti, baza. In dargehe ma dargehe naumidinist, sadbar agart, tobehe shikasti, baza. Baza means come, come back. Rumi also wrote many prose essays, which are less familiar to us than his poetry. Here's a passage from one of those essays. In God's world, there's nothing more difficult than enduring the ridiculous. Suppose, for instance, that you have read a certain book, corrected, amended, and fully vocalized it. Vocalize here means to put the vowels in. Languages that use Arabic script often write words as strings of consonants without vowels. It's like seeing the letters S, N, G and having to determine from context whether we're seeing sing, sang, sung, or song. Okay, so now you've gone through all this work of struggling sincerely with a book, putting those vowels in, and then someone sitting beside you reads that book all wrongly. Can you endure that? No, it's impossible. If, however, you've not read the book, it makes no difference to you whether the other person reads it wrongly or reads it right. You cannot distinguish wrong from right. So enduring the ridiculous is a great discipline. A sense of humor can help, but sometimes when people seem to be committed to misreading and misunderstanding what you write, or attacking you for what they say it says when they haven't even read it, a sense of humor can be difficult to maintain. I'll try to summon as much of my sense of humor as possible for the story that follows while we sing together hymn number 188, Come, Come, Whoever You Are. Well, a book fills the news. The whole world focuses on a single text, which few have read at all, let alone read correctly. People demanding that it be banned worldwide are killed in a riot. There are more riots in more countries, more deaths almost every day. And then the head of a religious state issues a death warrant against the author of the book. Millions of dollars and a place in heaven are promised to whoever will kill him. Some bookstores remove the book from their shelves. Two bookstores are bombed in Berkeley, California, home of the free speech movement. Soon, authors and free speech advocates also take to the streets with a sense of mission, all for a book and what it means to write one. What kind of book is this? It's a book of imagination, building on, drawing from, playing with history in its fiction. It's a book, like most books, by an author. This author's name is Salman Rushdie, and the book is called The Satanic Verses. The year is 1989. Supporters of free speech carry signs or wear buttons that say, "I am Salman Rushdie," to show support for both the author and his and this sacred freedom. 1400 years earlier, another book had filled the news. There were fewer kinds of media then. Excuse me, gossip, sarcastic poetry, catcalls and whispers, but the controversy sparked by this book dominated them all. The book and its readers were detested by those who claimed that it was wrong, bad, insulting. It harmed them by simply existing, whether they read it or not. Death threats were also made against the man most closely associated with this book and against his supporters. They suffered economic sanctions, social bans, and cancellations. What kind of book was this one? It's a book believed to have no human author. Instead, it's made known by a messenger relaying a message. That messenger's name was Muhammad, and the book is called the Quran. The Quran is not Muhammad's book. For Islam, its words are not words inspired by God, but God's own exact words, holy speech, every sentence, every word. The prophet simply shares his holy speech with the people. Muslims believe that God spoke his messages to the Archangel Gabriel, who next spoke them to Muhammad, who then spoke them to the world. Here's the chain of transmission: God, angel, prophet, people. But there's another angel, besides Gabriel, a fallen angel in Islam, just as there is in Christian tradition. His name is given sometimes as Shaitan, Satan, or sometimes as Iblis. Once God's favorite angel, he was cast from God's presence for defying God's word. When God ordered all the angels to bow before his final creation, human beings, us, this angel was the only one who refused, on the grounds that angels were created from light, but these human things were made from clay or mud. Do you tell me I had to bow to that? Humans? Ew! Ew! And so he lost his angel job and became a devil. Now he's very jealous, and he's also very resourceful. He wants to strike back at these muddy upstarts whom he blames for his downfall. How can he knock them down a peg? Why not attack God's chain of transmission and maybe mess up the still incoming Quran? Obviously, he can't get to God or Gabriel. The weakest link in the chain is Muhammad, a big-hearted human being who wants so much to help his neighbors out of their confusion and distress over the daily crisis atmosphere of a profoundly unjust society. As a former angel himself, Satan is able to speak words that sound like Gabriel's. So, speaking once more in his old angel accent, he slips some new verses to the prophet. Tilkal gharanik alwulla wa inna shafarata hinna turtacha. Arabic has a little different sound than Persian, doesn't it? These are the high-flying cranes, and their intercession is acceptable. These are the high-flying cranes, and their intercession is acceptable. These words, which the prophet repeats to the crowds, are also real crowd pleasers, since they seem to permit worship of some of the old Arabian gods as feather-winged helpers of Allah, the author of the Quran. This is the story of the satanic verses, as reported by generations of early authors whose Islamic credentials are considered impeccable. Did it really happen? Who knows? True or not, it's important to understand that tradition counts this story to Muhammad's credit. So does God. He quickly sends down new Quran verses, making light of the affair, and assures Muhammad that the same thing had happened to other prophets like Jesus. Here's a quote from, this is from the Quran now. "We have not sent a messenger nor a prophet before you, but when he longed, Satan cast suggestions into his longing. But God will annul what Satan has suggested. Then God will place his own verses right where they belong." So God is saying to Muhammad, don't worry. This whole mess just shows that you're a real prophet. That's what happens to him. So Salman Rushdie did not invent the story of the satanic verses. Instead, he made use of it in a powerfully imaginative novel that begins with two men falling together through the sky from an exploding jetliner. As they fall, they have conversations, they have arguments. One of these characters will become more and more deranged as the story progresses. He will murder the woman he loves, and then at last, take his own life. The scenes in the novel, which draw from the traditional story of the satanic verses, in fact, all of the passages in the book that were deemed offensive, t- take place in this sick man's mind. It's a difficult book to read. But if you conclude that such a tortured character's delusions are the book's real message, then, to use Rumi's words, you have read it all wrongly. If you insist on your conclusion and do so without having read the book at all, then, to use Rumi's words yet again, you are being ridiculous. Unfortunately, being ridiculous never seems to stop anyone from also being violent. In 1990, Salman Rushdie looked back at a year of reactions to the book, including the fatwa pronounced against him by the Ayatollah Khomeini. "I did everything that I could, using literary devices, to make it clear to any reader that I was not attempting to falsify history, but to allow fiction to take off from history. The use of dreams was intended to say, the point is not whether this is really supposed to be Muhammad or whether the satanic verses incident really happened. The use of fiction was a way of creating the sort of distance from actuality that I felt would prevent offense from being taken. I was wrong." Boy, was he wrong. Rushdie was trying to present something of real value to everyone who would take the time to actually read it, actually read his book and read it carefully. After 4 years of writing, his book had been carefully vetted by editors, reviewers, and publishers, none of whom foresaw the reaction that was coming. Nothing like it had ever happened before. Boy, were they surprised. Rushdie went into hiding. Many bookstores were bombed and several translators were killed or seriously injured. This should be no surprise if you've read the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa. "I am informing all brave Muslims of the world that the author of the Satanic Verses, a text written, edited, and published against Islam, the Prophet of Islam, and the Quran, along with all the editors and publishers aware of its contents, are condemned to death. I call on all valiant Muslims, wherever they may be in the world, to kill them without delay, so that no one will dare insult the sacred beliefs of Muslims henceforth." He also promises a place in heaven to whoever carries out such murders. You'll notice that the Ayatollah does not share a single word of Rushdie's to support his claims of harm to Islam. Well, he's a theocratic ruler from backward country, we all said. All this rage was being generated in places that had no tradition of what we call free speech. We thought such things could never happen in countries like ours. Or if they did, it could only be in certain backward, rural, or southern communities. We would never have thought that it could happen in a liberal, highly literate setting. We thought it must be impossible in communities that go by the name Unitarian Universalist. Boy, were we wrong. Fast forward from 1989 to 2019, and another book fills the news at the UUA General Assembly in Spokane, Washington. The Reverend Todd Eckloff, minister of the Spokane UU Church, begins to distribute a book he has written that's called The Gadfly Papers, Three Inconvenient Essays by One Pesky Minister. One essay called Let's Be Reasonable challenges some ideas about race and white supremacy that have become very popular during the daily crisis atmosphere of Donald Trump's presidency. When liberals are feeling frightened, angry, and confused, Todd wants to help us deal with our confusion, much like Muhammad did. So he subjects some claims made in a popular book published by the UUA's Beacon Press and written by a white millionaire who trains the employees of white billionaire bosses about their inherent racial fragility. He subjects those claims to rigorous logical examination and finds that they fall short of the standards of reasonable discourse. He questions whether such poorly grounded claims will help or hinder the cause of free and open dialogue about racial justice. He asks whether it is reasonable to characterize UU churches as bastions of white supremacy, like the Ku Klux Klan. Just as God counts the Satanic Verses event to Muhammad's credit, Todd credits us with being much better people than that white corporate trainer and certain UU leaders would make us out to be. On the same day that Todd's book appears, before almost anyone could have had time to actually read it, the attacks begin. In less than 2 days, a letter circulates on social media condemning his use of reason and logic as tools of white supremacy. Here's the cover note that accompanied the letter, and only ministers would have seen this, not the public. UUs, please take a moment and read this letter signed by more than 300 white Unitarian Universalist ministers in response to one of our own colleagues publishing and distributing a racist, transphobic, sexist treatise while we were at General Assembly. It's one of many responses, and they all declare that the views espoused in this publication are not representative of who we want to be as UUs. Read these comments, but please do not go out and purchase this book out of curiosity. Trust the hundreds of people who have seen it, especially our siblings of color and our trans kin who have been hurt by this. It's bad. Read the objections to the book, but do not read the book itself. Put thoughtful curiosity aside and join in condemnation. Trust what I assert about people being hurt, but do not try to verify my assertions. This is essentially an incitement to virtual mob action, though some of these colleagues did step out of the virtual realm and try to physically seize and destroy copies of the book in Spokane. The signers of this fatwa-style letter blatantly violated the UU Ministers Association Code of Professional Practice in effect at the time, which clearly states, "I will stand in a supportive relation to my colleagues and keep for them an open mind and heart. I will not speak scornfully or in derogation of any colleague in public. In any private conversation critical of a colleague, I will speak responsibly and temperately." Another guideline urges ministers to directly contact any colleague with whom they might have a serious issue. And yet the UUMA, instead of calling for balanced discussion, threw its full weight behind the mob screaming, "Crucify," if you'll pardon me for using an Easter metaphor when Easter's already passed. None of them were curious or brave enough to contact Todd directly. They attacked him without asking questions. He was expelled from membership in our professional association, then removed from ministerial fellowship, or excommunicated, if you will, by a community whose chairperson had signed the fatwa letter. All of this without ever citing a single passage or examining a single idea from the book they condemned, but that most had never even read. It was enough to assert harm without describing where or when or how the book had done such harm. Todd had challenged their sacred beliefs. A challenge to truth claims, it seems, is now the same as violence. New association guidelines created to justify the mob's actions define challenging a person's perceptions, opinions, and thoughts as, quote, bullying and emotional abuse. Easter provides us with a stark reminder of how the mob always treats a moral challenge. Crucify! The author of the letter's introductory note, the note that said, "Don't read the book, just trust me that it's bad," that author, rather than facing sanctions for uncollegial behavior, was rewarded with a paid position at the UUA's Siding with Love office. Yes, I said the Siding with Love office, almost like being given a place in heaven. What was it that Rumi said about enduring the ridiculous? Here it is again. In God's world, there's nothing more difficult than enduring the ridiculous. Suppose you've read a certain book, corrected, amended, and fully vocalized it, then someone sitting beside you reads the book all wrongly. Can you endure that? No, it's impossible. If, however, you've not read the book, it makes no difference whether the other person reads it wrongly or reads it right. You can't distinguish wrong from right. So enduring the ridiculous is a great discipline. I love that quote. That's why I've repeated it. If it's ridiculous to make assertions about a book that you've read carelessly, how much more ridiculous it is to attack an author for a book that you haven't read at all. Perhaps now I'm being ridiculous, but I think that free speech goes beyond being a simple right for most of us, or something that we merely value. It's something sacred. I mean this freedom itself, as much as what we express when exercising it. I trust that most of us value freedom of speech and expression and will fight hard in order to preserve them. Just remember that this fight comes with risks. As we review the Ayatollah's death sentence and recall how it wasn't just for Rushdie, here it is. The author of the Satanic Verses, along with all the editors and publishers aware of its contents, are condemned to death. All of them. Everyone who helps bring a book to readers or readers to a book. That's the way these Ayatollahs are, dealing out death, whether it's professional or physical. So deathly certain that they're the ones who are siding with the only sacred beliefs that are truly righteous and holy. Shortly after the Gadfly papers came out and the fatwas came raining down, many colleagues rallied in Todd's defense. Remember, please, that there are roughly 1,800 UU ministers total, most of whom did not sign the letter that the good Reverend Side with Love had circulated. We called for dialogue, for patience and restraint, and I think we also spoke for universal love, not just siding with it, but actually practicing it. For that, we were accused of complicity with racism, homophobia, et cetera, et cetera. When a group of us at last resigned in protest from our professional organizations, some of our colleagues banned us from speaking in their pulpits. I had just signed a contract to speak to a neighboring congregation. They had this peculiarity of giving you a contract form, where I'd been invited many times before. I'd already written the sermon. And then just before my visit, I was told that I'd been disinvited or canceled. The contract be damned. Later, two former ministers of the congregation I serve today posted online messages accusing those of us who'd resigned from the UUMA of opposing racial justice and promising that we would not be allowed to attend future collegial events or use the colleagues' chat line to post about things like best practices for hiring an administrator. I responded, sending them contact information for our worship committee and an invitation to please come visit us again. I got no response, as you might imagine. What these ministers have done is shameful, but I won't name them here because I still follow our old collegial guidelines, the ones that were rational, the ones that were kind. People, UUs have never acted like this before, canceling, censoring, and punishing each other for differences of approach or opinion. It's just not who we are. We are supposed to represent the best parts of religion, not the worst ones, like dividing people between the children of God who deserve heaven even when they commit murder and the children of Satan who deserve hell even when they do their best to tell the truth. For the past 3 years, I have seen UU values turned upside down and backwards. I don't plan to attend GA this year, but you might see me outside wearing one button that says, I'm Salman Rushdie, and one that says, I am Todd Eklof. If I wear the one that says Reverend Craig Morrow that I usually wear in my jacket, I may wear it ridiculously upside down, like flags are flown upside down, only as a sign of, quote, extreme distress and danger. 1 year after his world turned upside down, a year of extreme distress and danger, Salman Rushdie wrote, I feel as if I've been plunged like Alice into the world beyond the looking glass, where nonsense is the only available sense. Please understand, however, I make no complaint. I am a writer. I do not accept my condition. I will strive to change it, but I inhabit it, trying to learn from it. Our lives teach us who we are. Letter by letter, line by line, fully vocalizing our sacred freedom of speech and our active love of the truth, may our lives always do just that. Right here, right now, and in all the days to come. So may it be. Rumi wrote that enduring the ridiculous is a great discipline. He also said that when someone reads what we say so badly that it seems ridiculous, we should imitate a patient teacher who, when seeing poor work in a student's reading or their writing, does not shame them, but instead criticizes, here's Rumi, criticizes only a few letters out of a given line, then shows the child how they ought to be written. The rest he praises so that the child may not lose heart. The child's weakness gathers strength from that approval, and so gradually he is taught and assisted on the way. It's a firm but gentle method that I hope I can be patient enough to apply with children or students or righteous junior colleagues. Long after Rumi wrote those words, Salman Rushdie wrote these, I am a writer. I do not accept my condition. I will strive to change it, but I inhabit it, trying to learn from it. May our lives teach us who we are. May we, like Rumi and Rushdie and the Reverend Todd Eckloff, learn the great discipline of enduring the ridiculous. And may our lives, if they teach us nothing else, always teach us who we are. Amen.